You are listening to Appalachian Words, the show about language and culture in Appalachia. I'm your host, Jennifer Heinmiller. I am co-author of the Dictionary of Southern Appalachian English, a historical dictionary that is over 1.3 million words long and covers all sorts of words from Appalachia, from a hind to ewins. If you want to know more about those terms, stay tuned for news about the upcoming dictionary publication. It will be out next spring, 2021. The countdown is on. Appalachian English is, of course, a rich language with a history stretching back hundreds of years. But outside of the region, there are more stereotypes than honest conversation about the culture. So, in an effort to bring the language and its history to a wider audience, I decided to start this show. For each episode, if you're a longtime listener, you know, I read and discuss entries in the dictionary based on a theme usually, and I highlight different points about Appalachian culture and the relevant history. I also talk a little bit about how the dictionary is set up from time to time and the process of compiling it. And I'm sure in the coming months, especially as we're wrapping up the proofreading process, I will be talking about that a little bit more. So if you're interested, definitely drop me a line. If you've ever wanted to know how a dictionary is made, I can tell you all about it. I welcome your questions, comments, stories, any other message you'd like to send to me. And thank you so much to those of you who keep in touch with me and share your memories with me or ask questions. I welcome that at any time. It's really fun to have this little email community that we've created here. So thank you again for that. So welcome back to the mountains and foothills of Appalachia. You are listening to episode number 14. So first, as promised, a brief update on the progress of the dictionary. So I've been delayed in my podcast recording schedule. Again, I know I say that a lot, but you know how it is. Because I have been editing the manuscript quite heavily and getting through that as quickly as possible. Unfortunately, it's just one of those things where there are no shortcuts, and I wouldn't want to take any shortcuts. I'm trying to make this as nice of a final product as possible. And honestly, the editing team at University of North Carolina Press is absolutely amazing. Like, seriously, they are rock stars. So if you've ever thought about publishing a dictionary, not that I recommend it after going through this for 12 years now, definitely check in with UNC Press. I can't recommend them highly enough, and it's really been just wonderful working with them, and I think with their team helping me out, I think we're really going to create a beautiful book in the end. I know I'm biased, but we are all working really hard. They work just as hard as I do, which is a wonderful surprise, and it's a delight to see this thing really take shape. We're in the final stages now, and I really believe that it's something that you all, and hopefully many future generations, are going to be able to enjoy and keep around for years as a connection to this region and a connection to this language and the way of life that is rapidly disappearing. Unfortunately, it will not be available by Christmas. I have received several emails asking about that, and I am humbled and just flattered that you would want to give it as a gift. And unfortunately, that can't happen for Christmas 2020, but it looks like it could be a Mother's Day present. So if that's an option for someone in your life, keep that in mind. And definitely by Christmas 2021. I know it's still a ways off, of course, but that's certainly an option for next year. I don't have exact information yet. I don't know if University of North Carolina has that information yet either. But you can certainly contact the University of North Carolina Press directly if you are super curious. They may be able to give you more information than me. But as soon as I have a date, once that's set in stone, I will definitely pass it along here. And I will be more than excited to do so. Trust me, I've been waiting for it too. But as I said, we are working as quickly as humanly possible. But at the same time, trying to make it as nice of a product as possible. There's so much to include, just so very much as far as terms and examples, and we want to include as much as possible and provide really as much value as we can for this volume. So Thank you for your patience in that, and I look forward to giving you more updates in the very near future. I also wanted to address a broader topic that's been on my mind. And this, you know, it's a little bit more serious. But it has been on my mind, and I think it's something we should talk about. So here in Appalachia, if you've listened before, you know I live in Asheville, which is in western North Carolina, right in the mountains, one of the most beautiful places on earth. But here in Appalachia, and of course elsewhere in the U.S., people are more divided than ever before in living memory. I don't think that's any exaggeration. And I know it's not a secret either. And I recognize that this podcast is meant to be something of an escape from the harshness of reality. And perhaps, particularly this year, because it's also like nothing none of us have ever experienced in so many different ways, but both as a direct and indirect result of various current events. I want to say that I've never seen so much open hatred or just nastiness among people here, and it really cuts deep, and it truly saddens me and confuses me to see people arguing in public and looking at each other with such suspicion for various reasons. And you know, there's so many things going on, you can't even pinpoint it to one thing or one type of witch hunt. And I think that too often these days, no matter what the issue is, it's not only a matter of this us versus them and this kind of tribal mentality where if you're not one of us, you're clearly against us, and dissent in any way, and the tribe is going to attack you, for lack of a better comparison. But even more so than that, informing those snap judgments of people, it's like so many people are like looking at the outside world and looking at other people from inside their own houses through a window that's tinted by their beliefs and their preconceptions, rather than seeing someone as an actual person, an actual human being. And I think that in general, we should all strive to come out of our houses and see people, for human beings, for what they are, for who they are. Not just as political symbols, not as provocateurs, not as potential threats who want to destroy us, because people are people. And I know this is just incredibly hard during a pandemic of all times, and that circumstance certainly doesn't help anything. But we as Americans seem to have lost our curiosity to know others and learn about them as people, and to get to know individual cultures, individual people, individual beliefs from an angle of curiosity, to want to know more, to genuinely care about what someone else's experience is. We're stuck inside our own houses, I mean, literally and figuratively this year. And it's just gotten so intense. We're used to our own little bubbles. You know, we even used that term during the quarantine period. The bubble, the pod. I mean, you could easily substitute that with tribe. And I don't think that's a good thing in this case. And when we're stuck inside these houses, literally and figuratively, we have these decorations in our houses that we chose or we made, the colors that we chose for our walls, and we applied those ourselves, the curtains, and we can't look out that window and see the outside world without being surrounded and influenced by those surroundings that we constructed. And we need to do that. We need to step outside of our house to not be so influenced by the glass in that window, by that tinting, by those curtains that frame the people that we see through that window. We need to get out there. We need to be curious again and care about others and ask about them and genuinely want to know about their human experience, because that's what we're all going through. It's all a human experience for each one of us. And I think it is more important now than ever before in our lifetimes to see people as actual people, to take a step back and look beyond the political, the symbolic, and just see people as people. And along those lines, I also want to think about not only what is Appalachia. We see articles about that a lot. Of course, I've thought about it a lot, both for the podcast and working on the dictionary, this idea of what is Appalachia or where is Appalachia. There are many discussions about that online as well. Where does it begin? Where does it end? What is really Appalachia? Is Asheville really Appalachia? But beyond those discussions, I wanted to think about who is Appalachia. Now, this little podcast actually has listeners from all over the world. I do look at analytics and I can see those things. We have listeners from more than 20 countries, if you can believe that. Many of those countries are not typically English-speaking countries, and I am absolutely humbled and blown away. And I thank all of you, both, you know, in the U.S. as well as abroad. It's fantastic. What a time we live in. We have all of these methods to connect with people around the globe, you know, and it's become kind of a double-edged sword. But, you know, it shows that you just never know what will resonate with people and who your people might be. You just don't know. I bet many of you didn't know that you have this experience in common with someone in China, with someone in South Africa, with someone in Ireland, with someone in Russia. It's incredible, isn't it? And you can't just know that by looking at someone or knowing their nationality or their race or their gender identity or their sexual orientation. You can't get the whole picture of a person by knowing one tiny bit of information, no matter what that is. And I just see that snap judgment going on every day on the national level and on the micro level. Right here in the tiny mountain community where I live, and I know it's going on everywhere. And it just really saddens me. We have so many preconceived notions. And, you know, on a personal level, as an example, I'm sure those of you listening to this, you probably have an idea about who I am or the type of person I am, or maybe, you know, you imagine some things, but I may have mentioned in passing on previous episodes, but I don't think you would be able to tell by listening to this or just to look at me that I actually work for an international tech company. The podcast, unfortunately, is not my full-time gig. And I'm also bilingual in Japanese. So, 私は日本語話せるよ. So, you just can't tell when you look at someone. And I think we really need to not only be aware of that, but embrace it. Because we are all so multifaceted. So you can't get the full picture just by knowing someone's ethnicity, race, gender identity, choice of clothing, religion, any of those things. And I also want to say, along those lines, thinking about who is Appalachia, if something about this beautiful place or its language or its culture resonates with you, if something about it brings you home, you are Appalachia. We can celebrate its merits while at the same time learn from it the parts of its history that are not so beautiful and that we need to change. We don't have to stay the same. We don't. It's human nature. It's the nature of language, too. And that's a beautiful thing. And it's okay. It's actually encouraged. It's our culture, our region, and we can make it a welcoming and prosperous place. Even if you aren't from Appalachia, even if you've never been to Appalachia, even if your native language isn't English, I want to tell you that regardless of your race, ethnicity, religion, gender identity, or sexual orientation, if you love this region and you believe in building a peaceful community here to the extent you are able, you are welcome here. You have a home here. I know these are serious topics, but that's been on my mind quite a bit, and I wanted to make that clear. So, with a deep breath, let's move on and talk a little bit about Appalachian English. So if you're still listening, thank you for allowing me to express that. And in keeping with those ideas, when I was thinking about this episode, I thought I would like to talk about home in the concrete sense. So way back in the first episode, we talked about home place, which is both a concrete and abstract idea. And this time, I wanted to look at building the parts of a home and different types of home in Appalachia. So there are a few traditional house types and architecture styles in Appalachia that people may know about, but have largely disappeared. So I wanted to highlight those and shine a little spotlight on them. So in Appalachia, you often had a family farm or some kind of property where you might have more than one building. Or when you would set up your homestead, you would first set up a simple type of dwelling, and then later on you might build something more complex, or you might build a series of houses and barns and things. So one of the most basic types of these structures is called a blind cabin. And we have a great citation from 1913 from Horace Kephart, one of the early explorers of Appalachia, I suppose you could say. But really one of the first to document culture in Appalachia. And when I say culture, I am referring only to the European settler culture that was brought and developed here, somewhat influenced by Cherokee and other tribes, but largely the white culture. So we have to look at that mostly because it's the most well-documented at this point. So anyway, the blind cabin. So Kephart wrote, "Hundreds of backwoods families, large ones at that, exist in blind cabins that remind one somewhat of Irish hovels. Such a cabin has but one room for all purposes. In rainy or gusty weather, when the two doors must be closed, no light enters the room save through the cracks in the wall and down the chimney." So it sounded like this was a very survival-oriented type of cabin. And I'm sure you can imagine the conditions were probably not ideal to have a large family crammed into this single-room cabin. And of course, families were often quite large in those days. So these cabins are such that they did not have windows, just to make that clear. So you might have a little bit of light coming from the chimney, but not much to speak of at all. And then going forward to the 1990s, as of that time, when Michael Montgomery conducted some interviews with some older folks in the region, he discovered that these types of cabins were still found in the 1930s, but even at that time, they weren't used for living. So this is a very early, almost a prototype type of house. So I don't think we're likely to see any of those. Like if you go to Great Smoky Mountains National Park, you can see ruins of various cabins and buildings, but I don't think you're likely to find any of those. They were built mostly to be temporary structures. And the comparison to Irish cabins or hovels, as he called them, is very interesting because a lot of the settlers and influence in Appalachia actually did come from Ireland, the Scots-Irish people, Scotland. So it's not surprising at all that that influence would show up in the architecture as well. So moving forward, we have a little bit of a more sophisticated place called a shotgun house, not as violent as it sounds. So called because it is a very long house. So the way we define this is a narrow, one-story, box-like dwelling, having two or more rooms set one behind the other. And I don't know if you've ever been in an older apartment, particularly in a city above a shop. They had these, I think they're called like rail car or railroad apartments, where it's like you have to go through one room to get to the next room. And it's like a series of rooms in a very long tunnel-like layout. So if you're familiar with that at all, that's what this cabin is like, or this house cabin, whichever you want to call it. So We have some great material on this. So 1968, a book about Kentucky. The author writes, "Nearby the rows of shotgun houses of 3 and 4 rooms strung behind one another like the barrel of a shotgun and the squat box-like structures of the railroad shacks offered little of natural or man-made beauty to the large families of the miners and railroad workers who lived in them." Which is really interesting considering I was just speaking about the railroad apartment. I believe rail car. I don't know if you've heard of this. Let me know which one it is. But there's definitely some overlap in terminology there. And it is a shame that they write that this is really not beautiful at all. But they were very utilitarian. So 1980s, we have a novel by James Still. And he wrote, "Over the heads of the men, I could see the whole of the camp, the shotgun houses in the flat, the smoke rising above the burning gob heaps." So again, we have this set in a mining camp setting. And then another nice description. Shotgun house is a small, narrow house of 2 or 3 rooms, so named because if one opened the front and back doors, he could fire a shotgun straight through the 2 entranceways, which is such an illustrative description. I think it really gives us a great mental picture. And one more example here has to do with how they were actually built. So in the early 1900s, you could order houses from places like the Sears catalog, or house kits, where the lumber would arrive, and then it was just like a DIY, sort of like the IKEA version of a house. and I would imagine that the instructions were probably not very good, just like IKEA. Oops. But anyway, so this 2004 novel by Silas House describes, "She was meant to be in one of those shotgun houses that arrived pre-assembled on a railroad car." So it makes sense. These would be very quick ways of getting housing to mining camps if you could just stack them on rail cars. And it reminds me today of the prefab homes, the manufactured homes that you see in the South sometimes being trucked down the highway. If you've traveled along I-26, I'm sure you've seen that. These big flatbed trucks hauling these houses from here to there. It always surprises me. It's just amazing that you can transport a house to me. Maybe I'm easily impressed. But it's pretty easy to imagine these houses traveling on flatbed train cars, too. So next we have a type of house called a dog trot, and this was also called a dog alley or a dog run or a hallway house, also a turkey trot. So this one is a little bit more complicated, and we define it as a roofed passageway between 2 enclosed parts of a cabin, so the kitchen slash living room and then the sleeping quarters. And by extension, the house that has such a passageway. So the actual hall that divided the 2 large rooms, that was the dog trot. But then the house itself could also be called a dog trot or a dog trot house, dog trot cabin. So we also say here, the construction does not always reflect an original design as a second room or a house, as sometimes a room was actually called a house. It was sometimes built and joined to a pre-existing one, creating a wide shelter from the elements for both people and canines, and a space to store firewood, tools, furniture, etc. So this is one of those examples where you might build a house in stages. Say if you start construction on a house in the summer or fall, you just want to get one of those main rooms put together before the cold weather really hits. And then maybe at the spring thaw, when you have more time, more ability or manpower to get more logs or whatever the case may be, then you can add that second room and construct the dog trot between the 2. So doing it incrementally was not unusual at all. So for this one, we have quite a few examples here. So back in 1901, we had McClintock writing, "After the one-room cabin comes the 2-room. It consists sometimes of two rooms under one roof with an open space between called a dog trot. We have a book from 1937 that has a little bit more specific description. In the early development of the log cabin came the more adequate but still simple form of two rooms with a loft over each, the room separated by a covered passageway from 3 to 8 feet wide called a dog trot. 3 feet wide would be kind of a tight squeeze, especially if you're trying to store anything in there. But what's really interesting to me about this example is that the writer specifies that each of the rooms had a loft, and those would often be used for sleeping quarters. And I'm reminded of, I think, Little House on the Prairie, if memory serves. I know the books very well, but I don't know the show very well. It was slightly before my time, and I've seen some reruns. But it seems to me that they had a loft in one of the cabins that they lived in, where there was a ladder and Laura would climb up. Correct me if I'm wrong. Maybe I'm thinking of an entirely different show. But I do clearly remember that depiction on TV. And usually these lofts were accessed from a ladder. So not the safest situation, especially if you have small children. And then 1948, a book called The Dixie Frontier. After a time, as his family increased, the squatter who stayed in the area and became prosperous built a second cabin and connected the two by a covered passage 8 or 10 feet wide. This, commonly known as the dog trot, was a cool place for the family to eat in summer. So this is wonderful in so many ways. So apparently this person was able to see some fancier types with a much wider dog trot. It actually sounds quite nice in the summer, as someone who likes to enjoy meals outdoors myself when the weather permits. It seems like it would be nice. You'd probably get a nice cool breeze through there. And 10 feet is a pretty big space. I think there's a lot of room for the dogs, the kids, the firewood, and just to hang out and keep cool. And they also talk in this example about how you would add the second room and the actual dog trot passageway at a later point. So it seems in most cases they were not built all at once. It was kind of something to aspire to, or something that necessity dictated, depending on your family situation. And then we have, I'll read one more here. That's a really good one. So 1961, a book about the history of Haywood County. The author is Medford. I know I've referenced this one before, a wonderful resource. And Haywood County, I think, as I've mentioned, is not too far from me here in Western North Carolina. Another type sometimes seen was the dog trot house. This was really two houses, since the smaller one, the kitchen, was in line with the big house, the end doors facing each other about 4 feet apart. This space was bridged by a broad slab or strong boards, so crossing from one house to the other was easy. The dogs would often lie on this connecting boardwalk and would trot across it from one house to the other, hence dog trot house. Now, I gotta take that one with a grain of salt. That sounds a little too cutesy to me, but I'm a skeptical linguist, what can I say? I'm sure they did trot from one to the other, but yeah, I don't know. It's pretty cutesy, don't you think? But apparently in Haywood County, they were pretty stingy about the width of that that dog trot. Maybe they didn't want people hanging out there. Maybe it says something about the communities, how wide your dog trot was. Would be an interesting study to visit various communities and question people about how wide the dog trot was, to see how friendly they were, perhaps. Or maybe it just indicated how large their families were, or maybe simply how many dogs they had. Who's to know? So, along those lines, we also have turkey trot, which I mentioned. This is the exact same thing as a dog trot, but we have a great description here from a book published in 2003, talking a little bit more about the construction. So this says, Most families lived in houses partitioned into two pens or rooms or houses. All three terms apply. Some of these houses had an exposed hallway known as a dog trot or a turkey trot, separating the pens. A chimney was located at the inside center of the house on one or both gable ends, and many houses had a rear addition that often served as a kitchen. So, keeping with that double idea, we have the double cabin, and this one has a lot of various names. So this one can also be called a double house, a double log cabin, a double log house, double pen cabin, double pen house, double pen log cabin, double pen log house. I feel like an auctioneer. Anyway, this is a log dwelling having two enclosed areas or pens, again, that are essentially independent log structures connected by a roofed passageway that is sometimes enclosed. So, pretty much the same thing going on here. But we do have evidence that this was more popularly used than the term dog trot or dog trot house. So, as far back as 1885, we have an example, the fitful glimmer of firelight from an open door revealed the presence of a double log cabin. There was an unenclosed passage between the two rooms, and in this, a tall, gaunt woman was standing. I have not read this book, but now I want to. It's just such a beautiful image. You can imagine traveling across the Appalachian frontier and seeing that image just, you know, popping up in front of you. Could be either welcoming or ominous. Depends. Really depends. A 1914 book about Western North Carolina, we have: a single room was as much could be built at first, then followed a shed, a spring house, a stable, and a crib. Then would come the double log house. In some of these houses, there might be as many as six rooms, including two garret or loft rooms above the two main rooms of the house, and two shed rooms or lean-tos. So this is a great description of the kind of compound situation I was talking about earlier, where you have a piece of property with multiple buildings serving their individual purposes. A spring house was very important. This was built over a creek or right next to a creek, used for storage, to gather water. You know, water, of course, is one of the most important things, not only for a farm, but in life in general. So this was definitely an important structure. A shed for storage, a stable for your horses, of course. And then you may see this even now from time to time. I'm thinking about, especially in East Tennessee, some of these older houses, you do see the lean-to extensions where you have the cabin or the simple house and they've extended the roof and propped it up by poles or a partial wall, and usually used for storage of firewood or other things. I've often seen that around in Scott County, Knox County, Morgan County, that area of Tennessee. So not uncommon, even now, I would say. And then, yeah, even in 1968, I'm looking at the other examples we have here. Frequently, the cabin has another added to one of its ends. If the addition is made onto the chimney end, the house is a saddlebag. Here's another term for us. If the addition is built onto the end opposite the chimney, a double pen with end chimney house results. Both types came to be commonly built in log or frame as one-story houses composed of two equal units with two front doors and one chimney. So, and then we have one more here. There's a lot of examples here. It's hard to pick and choose, but let's go with this one. So this is from 1987. The single-room plan is often described as a one-room house. A more accurate description, particularly as it pertains to log construction, is that the single-room house was often a story and a half in height, creating an upstairs room. The bottom floor of a rectangular single-pen house was sometimes partitioned. Therefore, two or three rooms were possible within the log unit. Despite the possibility of two or three rooms within the plan, by modern standards, single pen houses were exceptionally small. Today, it is often assumed that small log houses were built solely out of necessity, either by early pioneers who had no access to sawed lumber or skilled labor, or by later mountaineers who were simply too poor or isolated to build anything else. Older people who speak of a single pen house often refer to it as a big house, or more frequently, big house and kitchen. And in that latter description, big house would refer to like the living room part of the house, and the kitchen would be the other room. So very interesting and very different from the type of houses that we typically see today. We also have the term saddlebag, which popped up in one of the examples, also called a saddlebag house, which is defined pretty much the same way, a log dwelling having two rooms or pens built back to back. Usually they share a chimney in the center, a design sometimes reflecting an original one-room dwelling to which a second room has later been added. So this can also be called a double chimney. So going from saddlebag to double chimney here, in a 1991 book, it was described as a house with a, quote, double fireplace or a double chimney or a stacked chimney, which I'll get into in just a moment. What else do we have here? Right. Okay, so moving on from the main house on a piece of property, sometimes when the kids grew up a little bit and they were ready to get married, another smaller house might be built behind the main one. This was called the wiener cabin or the weaning house, which is a very appropriate term, but I have to wonder if it came across as a little demeaning, or I don't know, maybe it was a point of pride. But anyway, this was a small cabin that served as a temporary dwelling for a newly married couple, and usually located on land owned by the husband's parents. So this was also called a honeymoon house or a marriage house, appropriately enough. And it seems that these were found all over. So 1960, we have an example that says a weaning house was a house built specifically for the oldest son. And he would move into it on the day of his marriage, presumably with his bride, although the example is not quite clear. But that's the assumption we're going to go with. And then 1965, a book about Cades Cove, one of the most beautiful areas of Great Smoky Mountains National Park. So the community here, they also use this type of structure. And we have an example talking about that. So later, the house was used as a wiener by the Shields family. When one of the boys married, he occupied the house until he could get his own dwelling built, or was weaned from the family group, as it was called. So kind of a... the term halfway house came to mind, but that's not really it. At least I hope not in most of those cases. But, you know, just kind of an intermediary house for him to live in while he's kind of getting his feet in the world, just kind of a stepping stone to that broader world, or till he could save up enough money to get his own farm and build his own... double pen cabin or dog trot or whatever he wanted. A few more examples here from a novel called Valley So Wild, 1975. A smaller house on Fed's farm became known as the Wiener Cabin. When any of his several sons married, he and his bride lived in the Wiener Cabin while he was being weaned away from home. He soon built a house of his own, freeing the Wiener Cabin for the next brother who needed it. So it looks like this was very much along the male side of the family, which is to be expected. Traditionally, even in, you know, European culture, where most of these families were descended from, that was the expectation, that a daughter would leave the house and go to live with her husband's family. So we can see that tradition carrying over even into this. So we also have here... one more example, up into the 80s, a writer reminiscing about language in Appalachia. So some parents had a small one-room house close by where the newlyweds first lived while waiting to build a house of their own. This was called a weaning house and was used over and over again as each child got married. So I kind of wonder what happened to the weaning house, like once the children were all married. Maybe it was used for other things, storage, guests. I have to wonder. I'm not really sure about that. But anyway, moving on a little bit. Earlier we talked a little bit about chimneys and how they could be centerpieces of a house, or a house could have two of them, or it could be set at the back. And sometimes the house terminology would change depending on the placement of the chimney or how the rooms were situated around the chimney. There were a few different types of chimneys as well, depending on availability, depending on the style, availability of materials, that is, or depending on the style that was preferred in a particular community or by a certain family. So chimney also has a few different pronunciations, most notably chimbley, if you've ever heard that. But a few types we have here. We have the stack chimney, which was also mentioned in one of those examples, I believe. So this was a chimney built of clay, mud, and sticks. Sounds, you know, not the prettiest thing, but usually they were pretty solid. So 1941, we have an example from Kentucky that says, "More elegantly built schoolhouses had stack chimneys of mud, sticks, and stones that vented both heat and light." So it sounds like they could be pretty useful. Ventilation was, of course, very important, especially when the rest of the building is closed up, and letting in light, of course, also important because you weren't working with a lot of windows, and sometimes the windows would have to be closed or covered with wax paper or oil cloth or something like that. So chimneys did serve as a sort of window in some cases. We also have stick and clay chimney, also called a stick chimney. And this is a cruder form of a chimney that was made of sticks that were daubed together. And this is a great word. So, daub is a verb used to mean building the chimney with mud, like especially that clay soil that you get so often throughout the South. But it definitely holds up well for construction, which is why it was used so often. So this one goes back quite a ways. We have an example from 1881. "The fireplace, several feet long, filled with ashes, made an ample spittoon, and the large stick chimney, aided by the winds that circulated freely through the cabin, afforded what I have so often wished for, an ample funnel for the escape of smoke and fumes of the tobacco." I think I would wish for that as well. Anyway, moving forward into the 20th century in the 1940s, we have a writer describing this type of chimney. "The house was an old log house with a stick and clay chimney, and an old woman came to the door and told him to come in." And then a little bit later, some terms gathered from around Estill County in Kentucky. A chimney made of twigs and clay. And of course, the fireplace or the hearth was, you know, one of the centerpieces of the house. This is where a lot of the family living took place, of course. And the chimney shelf, which was one of the terms for the mantelpiece, mantel board. There's so many names for it, which would go a shelf, you know, it was a shelf that would go above the fireplace. And it was also called a fireboard. And you may hear that today as well. I've definitely heard that myself from time to time. And this was like an area where you would put objects of pride, or things that you wanted visitors to see, or things that you wanted to be able to look at a lot, because this was a place that had a lot of visual real estate, so to speak, when people came in the house or just during different family activities. So we have some examples here. 1930, "Uncle Jake's clock was on this chimney shelf, the table extending almost from door to door, beautiful in the white cloth Shirley had given her." But in that example, the first part of it, of course, it goes on, it rambles a little bit. But in this example, it shows how a prized possession, Uncle Jake's clock, is kind of the focal point here. So they put it right on the chimney shelf so that it could be enjoyed by everyone. So looking a little bit at how the houses were actually constructed, we have some interesting terms here the word bat as a verb. So this meant, in this case, to nail strips of wood over cracks between boards or logs, as on the side of a cabin, in order to insulate it. And we do have a few examples here. We nailed a plank roof on the sheeting and batted the cracks, from 1943. And this is found typically in the southern Appalachian region, and it is a shortening of the form batten. Batten. I kind of swallowed that second syllable there. That's just my variety of English, but you may be more familiar with that term. And then going back to chimneys, we have cat and clay, which is actually a building material. And this was a type of clay that was mixed with sticks, straw, poles, occasionally stones that were used as building material for the chimney. And you can also refer to those types of chimneys as cat and clays or cat and clay chimneys. So this was actually a pretty commonly used term. And this one came directly from the British Isles. So we have examples of this in Scotland, Northern Ireland, Northern England. It's actually even in the Scottish National Dictionary, or the word cat is, meaning a handful of straw mixed with soft clay and used in building mud walls. And then we also have a very similar definition coming from the English Dialect Dictionary, an English meaning British English, a piece of soft clay mixed with straw thrust between the laths in building and mud wall, or building mud walls. So this came very directly from the ancestors of these communities, which is, it's so neat to see how these words travel and take different forms, quite literally. but just a few examples here. We have 1847, a book about pioneer life in Kentucky. He resided in the same original log cabin, which in course of time acquired a chimney carried up with cats and clay to the height of the ridgepole. These cats and clay were pieces of small poles well embedded in mortar. And ridgepole, I believe we've talked about that before, but that's the main pole of the roof. Yeah, it was, the chimney came up even to that that pole, which is pretty typically the image of a log cabin that you think of in this region. I can't think of examples where the chimney would be much of a different height, not to any great extent. But then in 1948, even 100 years later, talking about the Dixie frontier, the chimney was made of sticks and clay, known as cats and clay. We have the plural there again, so it's not always cat and clay, sometimes cat or cats and clay. The sticks were well embedded to keep the fire from burning them. The fireplace itself was made of clay, which is an important point, because if you did have the fragments of sticks or straw, if the proportion of those was too high relative to the clay, of course they could dry out and catch on fire, which was a very dangerous situation, of course. So, since we're running a little bit long on time here, I will save the interior of the house for another time. There are some curious pieces of furniture and different... just different parts of the Appalachian cabin and houses that might be a little bit different from what we're used to today, or from what people would see in other parts of the country. So I will end it there for now. It is the first week of October. It is absolutely gorgeous weather. I think this is one of the most beautiful falls I've ever seen in North Carolina or anywhere. So I am just enjoying it to the fullest and looking forward to Halloween, even though it will definitely be a different sort of Halloween. But just as a reminder, if you've listened this far, if you do have Halloween memories or scary stories or any sorts of stories relating to Halloween or All Souls Eve in Appalachia or elsewhere, please share them with me. You can drop me a line at appalachian.dictionary@gmail.com. I would love to hear that. I am collecting different memories and stories and traditions regarding Halloween and All Souls Day, on any traditions around the kind of spooky time at the end of this month. And I'll be putting those together for a Halloween episode, so look for that here in a few weeks towards the end of the month. And as always, if you want to get a hold of me for any other reason, feel free to drop me a line. I'm always happy to hear from you. But I will leave it there for this time, and I hope you are all enjoying a wonderful autumn as much as we can. So get out there, enjoy the beautiful leaves, and until next time, take care.